Around the clock, around the world, Bloomberg keeps you connected on television, online, on the radio, and on mobile.
I'm Lewis Lapham with The World in Time for July 9th. My guest is the historian T.J. Stiles, speaking with us today about the life and times of Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt. Your new biography, T.J., comes with the title The First Tycoon, and in the writing of it, you discover a man who bears little resemblance to the standard caricature of a grasping, ruthless, and illiterate brute. You find a revolutionary capitalist with whom it is also possible to associate the virtues of honesty, wisdom, and honor. How do you account for the two readings of the same character?
Well, Cornelius Vanderbilt was a man who got ahead by being driven. Often he was ruthless. He was a very difficult man to negotiate with. He could often be hard on his family. So the historical stereotype has some basis in truth. And yet, as I probe deeper into this person who, frankly, left no papers behind, it's very difficult to get at the real person underneath the historical image. I found a much more complex character, both in business as well as in his personal life. So I try not to take to go all the way the other direction, to say this was a nice, sweet man whom everyone loved. That's not true. But he was complicated. He was honest. He was true to his word. He was loving as well as hard on his family.
Also, his life, 83 years. He's born in 1794, dies in 1877 as the richest man in America. But there are enormous changes and contradictions within the story of America in that 83 years. So where does Vanderbilt begin? What's his descent?
Yeah, this is one of the most remarkable things about working on this book was the discovery of how the classic Gilded Age era of capitalism had its roots in antebellum America and even in the early Republic. And Vanderbilt's life was a wonderful way of tracing the changing American landscape. He was born on the shores of Staten Island in 1794 when George Washington was president. And he, along with his family, in keeping with his family tradition, he operated an open sailboat starting when he was 16 between Staten Island and Manhattan. But his parents were unusual because they were very market-oriented people. Staten Island was a rural place at that time. And like most Americans, they were small farmers. But they lived within eyesight of New York City, which was a small city at that time, about 35,000 people. But it was a dynamic international port. And being close to that market shaped their lives. And Vanderbilt learned the ways of business, learned the idea of how the marketplace worked from both of his parents. And he was operating along these lines, operating his own boats, which he slowly accumulated, until 1817, when a chance encounter changed his life.
And that chance encounter was what?
It was with a man named Thomas Gibbons, who was a representative of the older elite that had ruled colonial America. Gibbons was a Southerner who had moved to New Jersey. He was a wealthy planter. He owned numerous plantations in the South. He was a slave owner. And in the North, he mingled with a class of old aristocratic gentry, the Livingstons, the Schuylers, the Van Rensselaers, these manorial estates that gave rise to almost like an aristocracy in America. And due to a personal dispute with Aaron Ogden, Gibbons, who was another member of this class, Gibbons launched into a steamboat competition with Ogden, and that meant he was in competition with a legal monopoly on steamboats, which had licensed his enemy, Gibbons. That monopoly had been granted to the aristocratic Livingston family. So Gibbons hired Vanderbilt as his steamboat captain, and he rapidly became Gibbons' right-hand man in every respect, business operations, even in legal matters. Vanderbilt had very little schooling, yet he threw himself into the legal case against this monopoly. This case is fascinating because, on one hand, it's one of the first great examples of real public business competition in America. Secondhand, it led to one of the great cases in Supreme Court history in which Chief Justice John Marshall ruled that states may not erect barriers to interstate commerce, which was key to American growth and to Vanderbilt's own fortune. As you were talking about, Vanderbilt is a revolutionary figure. It was one of the last blows against the 18th century culture of deference, overturning the idea that the old landed elite should run everything.
Vanderbilt has allied with the new Jacksonian notion of a level playing field in the arena of competition, both in commerce and in politics. And I think you also say that in the winning of that case, he went down to Washington and talked to the lawyer who was arguing his side of the case, who was Daniel Webster.
That's right. He actually went in person to hire Daniel Webster and was interested in the case, made a point of staying in Washington to hear some of the early hearings. And I discovered something I haven't seen published before. Vanderbilt then brought his own case against the monopoly, which was next on the docket after Gibbons v. Ogden. And if there had been legal faults with Gibbons v. Ogden, then Vanderbilt v. Livingston might well have been the case that's now recorded in the law books and is taught in law school today.
So he breaks the monopoly, and now he's still a very young man, but he gets into his own steamboat business. First third of your book is called The Captain, the years of Vanderbilt's prowess as a steamship operator.
Again, the idea of competition itself was relatively new in America in the 1820s, 1830s, and Vanderbilt was very much the champion of competition. And he repeatedly went after the dominant transportation lines in a given market. So when the Erie Canal made the route between New York and Albany on the Hudson River a key route, he competed against the dominant monopoly there. When the Industrial Revolution took off in New England, the transportation between New York and Boston became a key market, so he turned to Long Island Sound. And through his mastery both of the technological aspects of building a fast, fuel-efficient steamboat, but also his mastery of the techniques of business competition and fare cutting and holding down costs, etc., he became a preeminent competitor. This was fraught with political meaning at the time because the Jacksonians, who were often called anti-business, were not anti-business. They actually favored the free market, allowing everyone to rise and compete, and they believed in the meritocracy. What they did not believe in was corporations, which they saw as an artificial device that made the playing field unlevel. And the Whigs favored corporations, but they disliked competition. So our modern categories for politics and the economy don't hold up. They don't fit the antebellum era. Vanderbilt, always practical, championed the Jacksonian view. He was a great competitor. And yet, he got involved in corporations very early on. His steamboats connected with the first railroads, some of the first railroads in America. And he actually entered into the stock market as early as the 1830s or 40s and actually became a president of a railroad company through a hostile takeover, basically, in 1847, which is decades before historians usually associate him with railroads. So again, as with the law, he was someone who immersed himself in whatever he saw as being necessary for his economic advancement. He was very quick intellectually speaking.
Also, he's allied with transportation and steam, which are the great engines of commerce in the early 19th century America. Carry the story of his steamboat days and steamship days up through the story of the Nicaragua transit, gold rush in California, and Vanderbilt reaching the pinnacle of steamboating.
1849, when the California gold rush started, Vanderbilt, within 2 years, had stepped out of these regional transportation lines around New York, in which he was a dominant figure, and he became a national or even international figure. The federal government had subsidized a steamship line that ran from New York to Panama, where a railroad was eventually built, and then from Panama up to San Francisco. Vanderbilt decided to, when he saw the size of the gold rush, he decided to compete. And initially he tried to build a canal across Nicaragua, which was farther north and largely traversed by natural waterways. Unfortunately, British bankers, who he was counting on for capital, decided it wouldn't pay and they refused to invest. But he established a transit route across Nicaragua and became very wealthy, immensely increased his wealth in the process. These were years of not only international stature as he became the creator and ruler of one of the United States' key connections to California, which was, of course, on the far side of an unpopulated continent. But also, it involved him in tremendous international difficulties when an American adventurer, a filibuster named William Walker, launched an expedition to Nicaragua, ended up taking over the country, and then allied himself with Vanderbilt's business enemies, took away the transit rights from Vanderbilt's company, and his rivals set up their own steamship line and transit route across Nicaragua. Vanderbilt tried to get the U.S. government, tried to get the British to intervene, who had a protectorate over the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua. They refused. So he ended up negotiating with Costa Rica, which went to war with William Walker's government, and actually sent a secret agent and a crate of gold and a plan for cutting off Walker from his reinforcements of young American men flocking down to fight for him. And Vanderbilt actually turned the tide of that war with his secret agent capturing steamboats on the San Juan River in Nicaragua. A just remarkable story. And one of the first cases we see of U.S. businesses intervening overseas.
Carry the story forward to the Civil War. At the beginning of the Civil War, again, Vanderbilt is already one of the richest men in America. He has the largest fleet of steamboats, both working in the Gulf of Mexico, the Pacific Coast, and in the Atlantic Ocean. And how does he stand on the war? What does he present to the Lincoln administration? And what are his thoughts or attitude towards slavery?
By 1861, when the Civil War erupted, he was universally known as the Commodore, which was then the highest rank in the U.S. Navy. He was a major national figure. In a way, few businessmen even today are. He was a man who was enormously focused on his economic interests, and yet his one great sentiment was patriotism. As I like to say, he named his sons after his heroes. William Henry, after William Henry Harrison, the general and president, George Washington, and he had another son named Cornelius Vanderbilt. So you have his three heroes with his three sons. Apart from pride, patriotism was a great sentiment for him, and he tried very hard to help the Union Navy from the outset. He tried to donate his largest steamship, the Vanderbilt, to the Union Navy. It was worth close to $1 million, one of the largest and fastest ships in the world at the time. And initially he got turned down, but then the Confederate ironclad, the Virginia, the converted Navy steamer, the Merrimack, steamed out of Norfolk Harbor and wrought havoc on the Union blockade fleet. And all of a sudden, the Union government was very interested in having the Vanderbilt on its side. Vanderbilt himself went to Washington, consulted with Lincoln, consulted with Secretary of War Stanton, and he not only donated his largest steamship to the Union Navy, he re-equipped it as a warship with a ram and with weapons, with a certain amount of armor, officered it with men of his own choosing, and brought it down to Hampton Roads, where it helped bottle up the Merrimack until the Confederates finally decided to sink it.
And he does this at his own expense and without asking for any payment from the government.
That's right.
In his dealings with competition, he's never taking, as far as I know, government subsidy. I mean, he's competing with railroad lines, shipping lines that are feeding on government subsidy, but Vanderbilt doesn't do that.
That's right. His beliefs were always flexible according to his interest. For example, in his championing of competition, he was always happy to come to terms to end a particular competitive battle, even though he remained ready to fight under all circumstances.
Let us get to his shift. At the age of 70, he gets into the railroad business.
Well, in 1846, he had settled permanently at a brownstone townhouse off Washington Square, surrounded by the sort of classic patrician families that Edith Wharton chronicles in her novels. He lived the lifestyle of a wealthy, elite New Yorker, and yet it took decades before he was actually accepted into their ranks. Actually, one of the surprises in my book is that he eventually was accepted by them, though it took a great many years. Part of that transition was not merely his wealth, but also the way his change into railroads sort of changed his relationship with business culture at the time. In 1863, at the age of nearly 69, he suddenly sold off his steamship enterprises and went into railroads, which, as I mentioned, he'd been involved in for decades. But he went in with both feet in 1863. And through a series of business battles, he took over one line after another until he controlled a set of lines that connected Chicago to New York. By 1869, he completed this basic process, and he consolidated his companies within New York into one of the first giant corporations in American history, the New York Central and Hudson River Railroad. Railroads, unlike steamships, if they are competing, they can't move. If somebody loses, they're still there. Even a line in bankruptcy continues to operate and compete. So the impetus in railroads was always to control or eliminate competition, and Vanderbilt took part in this. He was ready to fight if challenged in a rate war, and yet he worked very hard to try to create cartels that would set rates across the railroad industry. And ironically, this makes him a much less attractive figure in terms of his economic standing in our eyes today. But for New York society, he emerges a much more diplomatic and acceptable figure. And even personally, the rough-hewn young sailor who had got involved in fistfights, which I proved with court records he actually did, in later years became quite dignified. And though he always wrote phonetically, his speech and his few handwritten notes that survive show a much more formal pattern of speech, very clear and articulate. So he began to sort of grow into the dignity that his millions gave him. And he became a more controversial and ambivalent figure in the economy, but he became a more acceptable figure culturally speaking.
He has thoroughbred horses that he likes to race. He attends the summer season at Saratoga Springs, so he's become an eminent social figure. And by this time, he has how many children?
Well, he had a total of 13 children. One died when quite young. His son, George Washington, died during the Civil War of illness. And he had another daughter who died. She had some unnamed congenital problem and was an invalid all her life. She died at the age of 40. So that left 10 children that actually survived to adulthood. You know, he was surrounded by his daughters. His sons-in-law were important players in his businesses. He brought them in and gave them a start. And yet he was very concerned to found a dynasty. In essence, he said, I haven't created this great corporation, this great empire, to simply have it, as he said at one point, have it dispersed and broken up upon my death. He wanted it to survive and in the Vanderbilt name. So his oldest son, William Henry, was already his business operational manager toward the end of his life. And Vanderbilt very deliberately made him the heir to the family fortune. He wanted to found a dynasty.
And how large was that family fortune in 1877 when Vanderbilt dies at the age of 83? You open your book with a reading of the will. Give us a sense of the scale of that fortune.
Well, the best estimate that people had at the time was $100 million. I don't convert historical figures into modern equivalent amounts because I don't think they're meaningful. But one thing I do to give an idea of the scale of that wealth at that time is I compare it to the amount of money in circulation. Of course, these are $100 million is the value of his assets. Not he didn't have that in cash in a vault somewhere. If Bill Gates, before the financial crash of 08, could have sold his entire, I forget, $58 billion estate for cash to American buyers. Using the Fed's M2 figure, he would have taken one out of every $138 in circulation. If Vanderbilt could have sold his entire estate for cash to American buyers at full value at the time of his death, he would have taken one out of every $20 using cash and demand deposits. So the scale of his fortune is frankly unimaginable. And it was deployed in such a way that he monopolized New York's rail connections, not completely, but the connections that actually ran into Manhattan, he fully monopolized. And he had this one of the great railroad empires in America. That made him immensely powerful as well as wealthy.
Also, he begins as a revolutionary, fighting on the side against monopoly, and ends as a conservative. I mean, I realize the terms aren't exact, but on the side of monopoly. So his life and times spans the change and what happens to America in the 19th century.
That's right, and he was right at the forefront of that change. And one of the great changes is driven by the new scale of business that begins to emerge around the time of the Civil War. Jacksonian Democrats believed that laissez-faire was an egalitarian philosophy because, you know, there were no large corporations. If you go out today and tell somebody, well, you know, go out and compete and, you know, one day you'll be as big as ExxonMobil, you know, you'd think it's absurd because ExxonMobil is so vast. No one individual could become that successful. Before the Civil War, though, that was a very plausible thing to say. The railroad corporation led the rise of big business. And Vanderbilt, by being involved in railroads and corporations from very early on, and by consolidating railroads and through business logic creating giant corporations, was at the forefront of this change in scale that altered our political ideas about the economy. Laissez-faire became conservative, and Vanderbilt let the government keep the government out of regulating business. As business got to be so huge, that became a conservative philosophy.
So our first tycoon is also the template of the way in which the corporation and our business world evolves into the 20th century.
I think very much so. And One of the interesting things, too, is the way in which in a completely unregulated stock market and financial markets in the 19th century, you see a lot of the behavior that we've seen more recently in cold, stark terms. Less complicated because the world was less complicated, but also easier to identify. For example, you know, Goldman Sachs and a hedge fund called Magnetar have been accused of creating credit default swaps and CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, that were designed to fail, and that they deliberately contributed to the panic of 08 and the financial crisis in order to profit. Vanderbilt did much the same thing in 1869 to crush a rival he was fighting for control with over the Lakeshore Railway. He deliberately contributed to a panic by collapsing the price of Lakeshore stock in order to bankrupt that rival. The economy is so much smaller, the financial markets are so much smaller, that after his enemy went bankrupt and had to sell off all his Lakeshore stock, Vanderbilt went into the market and began to buy. And he actually arrested the panic that began on Black Friday of 1869.
Thank you, T.J. Stiles, for speaking with us today about the life and times of Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2010.